Okay, welcome back, everybody. I must say I'm enjoying being here and enjoying the breeze coming through. Day before yesterday, it was about 106 at Abayagiri. This is a whole different existence, a whole different realm. I thought we could begin the afternoon with just some Q&A. I think trying to watch our breath right after the meal is a recipe for disaster. So that we can give the opportunity if anybody and anything that's come up in the morning. Have questions about or want to pursue further, but just open it up for questions. Yes.
Was he that unhappy that he kept thinking about all these ideas? I mean, was his life that miserable?
His life was not miserable. His life was incredibly privileged.
But internally.
Huh?
Externally, it might have been, but internally,
yes.
He must have been very...
Yeah, he was motivated.
Right, but where did that motivation come from?
Internal. It depends how one wants to look at it. Psychologically, one could analyze it into a dissatisfaction with the world around him, limitations of a royal existence. But also, if you look at it on a more, say, mythologically, or the story of the Buddha is not about this one individual life, but that it's a culmination of many, many lifetimes of seeking and then being able to fulfill that aspiration.
So do you think that if he was born anywhere else in the world, how do you think he would turn out the way he did, or the circumstances?
There's certain elements of circumstance. I remember when I first started reading Buddhism, and in the commentarial tradition of Buddhism, there's a... it said that all the Buddhas are born in India.
Okay.
And I kind of, you say, oh, what a load of rubbish. And then reflecting over it over time, there is something very special about the cultural setting of India, the values and the spiritual relationship to life and existence is very different in India. There's a real high cultural value placed on the religious seeker, and that kind of willingness to renounce the world is very, very strong. And there's a high cultural value placed on that. Very different than, say the Chinese culture is much, much older, but a very different cultural value. So to the point, as an example, say that even in Chinese culture now, Buddhism has been there and has thrived for a long time, but Buddhism is still registered as a foreign religion. Mm. It's a very different cultural perspective. An Abrahamic religion doesn't have the same relationship to the world and samsara and the value of liberation. it's an interesting perspective.
Thank you.
You have a...
Yeah, I've been confused between intention and desire as mm-hmm. I've been with you. And when you have been speaking about desire, even if I'm not going there, I just say desire for me is coming from a craving, from a sense of not even conceptual, but just this energy inside of me just saying, oh, this is what I want. So I know you were talking about something else. You said wholesome desire.
Yeah.
So I have just a language where it's not really, it's complicated. I'm sure it's something else. Yeah. But we'd love to hear more about that. Intention, aspiration, mm-hmm. desire.
Yeah, I mean, those are, it's really helpful to parse that out. Because the nature of desire, how we conceive of it usually, and particularly from a Buddhist sense, it's sort of seen like desire is the cause of suffering, therefore it's a bad thing. But, you know, there's a whole spectrum of desire, and we have to learn how, and we can't actually accomplish anything without having desired it. So to be able to formulate and follow through on a skillful desire system is what will bring happiness and well-being or peace. But it's learning how that works, because usually the nature of desire, it pulls us. And until we learn how to, say, to watch, to investigate, to understand, then we'll keep being pulled by it. Does that help?
Yes, I like that. What about intention? Is that similar to desire?
Intention, let's see, from a Buddhist... From a Buddhist perspective, say how that word intention is used. I'll relate it to a Buddhist technical term, jetana, which is the volitional impulse toward anything. So that, 'cause sometimes intention is actually in the English language, it is a bit murky, a bit unclear how it's used and defined. So that, but this word intention that is usually translated from jetana, the word jetana, yeah, is that volitional impulse toward that movement of mind towards something, and it can be skillful or unskillful. But it's also the basis for all action, whether it's by body, speech, or mind. And this is where also when the Buddha defines karma, karma is volition, or is intention. So that it's because it's we formulate. An intention, a volition, the mind moves towards it, We think, we feel, we speak, we act from that. And that's, and the word karma is actually the verb to do. So it's, and whatever is done has a result. So we've got to pay attention to that. Okay, there's a person there.
Do you think that all manifestations of desire or motivation are ultimately a desire for happiness and well-being, or are there motivations for other things, truly negatives, that have nothing to do with happiness and well-being?
Well, I mean, in the sense that oftentimes the desire for happiness is built on, say, like my personal happiness is built on taking advantage of this person or getting even with this person, which is really negative. But one conceives it in one's mind that one's going to get some kind of satisfaction out of it, which is it's kind of messed up, but it's the way the mind works. But that's, again, that's why it's so important to really understand that dynamic, because then we can start utilizing it rather, because oftentimes we're afraid of desire, but then when we don't understand it, then it has the capability of being problematic. But the more we can understand it, then it can be used and implemented skillfully for our benefit and for the benefit of others. Because in the end, say, like, our happiness is also the happiness of others. If we have any kind of happiness that creates some suffering for somebody else, and then it's going to come back and bite us somehow. So it behooves us to really understand how to create happiness so that it's of maximum benefit for ourselves and for others.
Yeah, I have a question about... sorry.
There you are.
Not sure how to be with people, particularly close friends or family members who, out of their desire to avoid pain and find happiness, they engage in very self-destructive behavior that is also extremely harmful to others around them. Mm-hmm. And part of me has compassion, but part of me I just don't know how to be with them, how to handle that.
Yeah, and sometimes... sometimes it's what comes to mind is in the discourse that the Buddha gave on the highest blessings, there's 38 things that were of the highest blessings. The very first one is don't associate with fools or with people who aren't good people, which is obviously you can't go around judging everybody, but there are circumstances where somebody is toxic, or in that sense they're oftentimes they don't understand their own life well enough that you can trust being close to them. And yes, one wants to try to be kind or compassionate, but then one also has to learn how to be wise in terms of protecting oneself. And so that those two go together. They can't be separate, really.
So how did you get through the 106 degree heat? Did you have a different schedule, or did you? Just interesting.
Well, it's a regular feature of summer in Mendocino County. So, or especially in the, you get a bit more interior. Yeah, you still breathe in, breathe out the same way. Yesterday we had we were going to have a community work day, and that got canceled. So it was just too hot, and there was a few people who were still keen to do something, so had everybody work up in the workshop where it was really cool. you just adapt, adjust. The very first time that I came to that area, I was, say, Ukiah. It was 1991. I was invited by City of 10,000 Buddhas, which is a Chinese Mahayana monastery. They were having an ordination. I was still living in Thailand, and it was late June, that's kind of the worst of the hot season in Thailand, because it's hot. It's also humidity is at about 99%. It's just really sticky and hot. And then I had this invitation to come to America to join in the ordination. I said, "Wow, I'm going to get out of the heat. I'm going to have to," because America. I mean, I hadn't really been here before. And it's got to be cool. And I got the day I arrived. It was 115. Where am I? What am I doing?
It's called. Because
I landed in San Francisco, and of course, yes, this is it. Because it's cool in San Francisco, but it's not up in Ukiah.
Way in the back.
Hi. Are there different stages of enlightenment?
There are. Classically, there's what's called the stream enterer, which means one has entered the stream of Dhamma, entered the stream of truth. One has seen and experienced the true nature of things. One's had a glimpse of the goal of Nibbana, that's transformative. There's actually no going back after that. In a sense, there's no retreat. In the sense of falling away from that truth. So that's a particular stage of enlightenment. Then there's three further stages. culminating in the full enlightenment of an arhant.
Okay. And how would one know that you've reached the first stage, or just someone? Do you?
I mean, there's certain elements that are. One of them is that one is there's no doubt about the efficacy and the truth of the Buddha's teachings or the Buddha's path, so that doubt has faded away. Which is sometimes a good indication, sometimes not. It's probably a pathological condition that is somebody's free from doubt like that. Totally convinced of something. But it's a very different kind of, you know, it's really, doubt has fallen away, it's become clear. There's also a falling away of the the identification with the mind and the body and the constituents of the mind as me, as self, as I, as mine. That's a huge piece of it. So that's falling away. That's a tremendous kind of freedom and relief. And then also a falling away of the assumption of, say, like purification coming through some kind of external means. See, either through following, it isn't as if one doesn't practice precepts or have a training, but one realizes it isn't just, if I just did this, if I just kept the precepts, if I just kept watching my breath in and out, you know, then I would finally become enlightened. One realizes that purification comes through an understanding and penetration, as opposed to some external method or some kind of blessing from the guru or whatever.
Thank you.
Okay, we're getting lots of questions now.
Okay, I have a question about what to do when you have a lot of freedom in your mind, but in your body, you're stuck with a bad habit. So there's a lot of happiness on one level, but on another, there's a habit that is a lot of suffering. How to apply, and what application to that?
It's still, the mind's still involved. There isn't really a separation of mind and body in that way. It might be experienced through the body, but the mind's involved. It's a participant. That's where the really learning to question, to look, to experience, It's interesting in the like in meditation instructions. Oftentimes, there'll be the instructions to watch the breath or to watch the mind. And there's in that language, we'll tend to separate kind of the object of our attention there, and then the observer here. And the language that the Buddha used is much more direct, and it's probably better translated, like in the instructions to mindfulness of breathing, experiencing the breath coming in, one breathes in, experiencing the breath going out, experiencing feeling, experiencing the mind, so that there's a direct relationship and engaging with both the body and the mind. And it's as we experience and engage more closely, then we start to see how they work together and how we can free ourselves from the things that end up in a place of dissatisfaction or discontent. Okay?
Thank you.
Okay. we'll get there.
Thank you. Thank you for today. And I was wondering if you would speak to something you've mentioned that that I really identified with, was that how we sink in to a place and that you lift yourself up and you kind of lift with brightness.
Yeah.
And anything you could say about that?
Yeah, that's, I think that's, because again, so like the language and assumptions that we were used to in, say meditation instruction and guidance, we talk about the, concentration, okay? Concentrate the mind. And when we concentrate the mind, or we focus on our breath, and when we focus or concentrate, you can almost feel yourself going down. Ooh, you're like, there's this, and there's a certain tension there as well, because we tend to try so hard to do it. But I think it's more helpful to conceive of our efforts in meditation as and investigations, or like sitting in a kind of comfortable open space, relaxing, and then just lifting the mind up to the object, like lifting the mind up to the breath, and almost like riding the breath, and then lifting that up, or lifting the mind up to that reflection on impermanence or whatever, so that we're not sort of, grappling with it and basically getting sucked into it, really, so that it pulls, we pull the mind down, I think a lot of people experience, and that's certainly my own experience from meditation, is it's just so easy to also even the goal of the meditation, like absorption, like absorbing in, so that we you have to pay attention to how those words affect the imagery that comes up and the response, so that, as I think it's helpful to lifting the mind up to it, or brightening the mind, so that there's some space around things. Then we get to experience it and feel it and touch it in a different way, and that we get to understand it more. This lady here.
I'm wondering if you have any advice about cures for burnout. Cures for burnout.
Oh, okay.
I'm in a helping profession, and I just feel, when I came here today, I noticed I felt depleted and exhausted, and I've been doing this kind of work for a really long time. I'm not new, but I still need help with getting the balance between giving and receiving.
Yes, yes. No, that's in the, it's very, very common, very, there's something we have to really be attentive to. It's really interesting, the sense of sometimes how language conditions us, because even the word compassion in the English language means to suffer with, and suffering with too much, you end up burnt out. It's just too much to carry. So that the ability to recognize that there is suffering, obviously. There is a need to be helping, assisting, giving. But we also have to know when to, say, be compassionate toward ourselves as well. We have to look after ourselves in order to be able to give. There is a tendency in, particularly in American culture, Western culture in general, but American culture in particular, it's a culture that is very much, one of the foundations is that there's a very strong idealism, so that it starts to factor into many of our, how we approach things, so that, yeah, in an ideal world, you just give and give and give, and everybody be happy, including yourself. But when it comes to, you know, kind of the reality, the ideal is not a good basis to be working from. It's like one of the images that Ajahn Chah gives, in terms of, particularly in that sense of giving and helping and engaging, said, you know, you have to know your own strength, and he said, you know, the image he gave, don't think you're a 10-wheel dump truck when all you are is a wheelbarrow, and it's, you know, and it's not. And that's looking down at wheelbarrows. Wheelbarrows are really good. But we have to sort of see, if we overload that wheelbarrow, we keep it working, and it's not going to last very long. So that similarly for ourselves, we have to really pay attention to what is it that we need to do to look after ourselves, because that's, you know, when in the classical instructions for the cultivation of loving kindness and compassion, the first person that you direct loving kindness and compassion to is yourself. And it's just so important. And oftentimes from our feeling, from our cultural feeling, is that selfish. And it's not. It's incredibly necessary and practical, because our ability to be with others and to help and to give is dependent on our being kind and compassionate to ourselves, and it's just so essential to see ourselves as worthy of loving kindness and compassion, and it can be a stretch sometimes, because it's you know, that again, that kind of the idealism is outward looking and forgets the base that we have to build on. And so it's a really important a foundation to be attending to, and it's not selfish. It's the way that we can lay that foundation so that we can be giving, and so that we can be present for people.
Do you want more questions?
One more question.
One more?
Yeah. Yes.
Is sexuality and wanting an intimate connection with another considered a negative desire?
Depends. No, I mean, there's you know, it's just in the same way of, you know, is eating food a negative desire? Depends how you approach it. What are the boundaries? What's the result? What is our relationship to the food? So, in the same way, with a sexual relationship, is not. It's got a whole realm of relationships that we have to pay attention to, and make sure that they're that they are operating from a place of attentiveness and care, and a lack of selfish desire, and a lack of manipulation, because it's really loaded, and it's just so important to pay attention, and that's why it's so important to understand the desire, the function of desire. What is it trying to get, and is it actually appropriate or inappropriate? And that's also why, say, like in Buddhism, precepts are so important. Because they establish boundaries of trust in terms of how we relate to each other as human beings. So it's not so much a matter of just thwarting desire, but understanding how desire works so that we can build those bonds of trust and care. Okay, so we have some Q&A already. We've been sitting for a while. Why don't we go and do another session of walking meditation? And we'll come back in about, 35 minutes or so.